This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. This year's elections have been some of the most contentious and unusual, from the presidency to Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race to local legislative seats. Now that Election Day has come and gone, we'll sort through what happened in this year's election. Joining us in studio are Tim Dale, political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Joe Heim, also a political science professor at UWL, and Keith Knutson, a history professor from Viterbo University. Thank you all for joining us today. And first, I want to talk about the 32nd Senate race. Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling held on to the seat by 58 votes. That's a pretty close margin. And most people are now expecting Dan Kopinke to request a recount after the votes are canvassed. Keith, in what ways was this race unusual before people ever went to the polls?
Well, Jen Schilling has a history of winning in this district. Of course, she defeated Dan Kopinke in the recall election. But since then, she's held the seat quite securely. My view is that the closeness of the race is a result of the rural turnout in support of Donald Trump. And so I think this, although it looks like Dan Kopinke will not prevail, we'll see out of a recount. But this is a coattail effect from Donald Trump down ballot.
Right. Joe, obviously people were expecting this race to be competitive, but, did the pollsters and the pundits, did they expect it to be this close?
About a week before it, I'd say the answer was no. But there was generally a Republican surge, I think, throughout, especially rural Wisconsin, and that Dan Kopinke certainly was benefited by that. I had heard earlier on, more than a month ago, that it was a relatively close race. A Republican told me that it was, just a few percentage points. Dan Kopinke was down a few percentage points. So that could be made up, obviously, by people who are undecided or people that decide to vote that previously had not been predicted to vote. The race actually was in two parts. It was the 96th Assembly District, that's Lee Nearson's Assembly District, which is Vernon, Crawford, and parts of Monroe. That area gave Dan Kopinke a margin of, last I saw, was around 3,000 votes or so. So we came into La Crosse County. La Crosse County tended to vote more Democratic in this election, and that's where Jennifer Schilling made up her numbers. At one point, it looked like she wasn't going to be able to do that, but with the write-ins and the, not the write-ins, I'm sorry, the absentee ballots, which they counted very late, she kind of caught up at that point. So it was really kind of a race of two parts of the district, the La Crosse County versus the Vernon Crawford rural area.
And as Keith mentioned, Jennifer Schilling and...
Let me mention one other thing. This is a unique race because you had a former state senator who was replaced by a current state senator in a recall election, all of which made it very unique. And both people are very well known. It wasn't a matter of name identification, but it was also a matter of popularity. Both of them were relatively very popular people for the most part.
Right, and because of this history between the candidates, neither of the candidates during the race really talked about the fact that they had faced off before and really talked about the fact that this was a rematch or a grudge match, maybe some might say. But, Joe, do you think that the voters maybe thought of it as, had that on their minds when they went to the polls?
Yeah, it's a question whether a voter might have said, we were mad at Dan Kopinke, 4 years ago, and now turned out he was right, or people that were supporters of Jennifer Schilling, mainly because they were mad at Dan Kopinke and essentially changed their mind. That certainly is possible. I think to the degree that there was a grudge match, it was not between the two candidates. They gave no indication it was, publicly and even privately. But you might have assumed that maybe some Republican voters and the Republican Party in general saw it as a grudge match, time to get back at Jennifer Schilling for what they might have seen as a unfair taking of the seat. A lot of people don't like recall elections and don't think that's an appropriate thing to do. So people thought it was wrong, simply wrong for Jennifer Schilling to beat Dan Kopinke, might have considered a grudge match.
And Tim, you know, one other factor in this race that I want to talk about was Chip DeNoor, the independent candidate in the race. And, you know, he had around 2,000 votes, which is not a lot usually, but in this race divided by 58 votes, I mean, that seems like a lot. I mean, who did Chip DeNoor help, or maybe the question is, who did he hurt in this election?
Well, if we're just going to look at ideology or principles, we'd probably say that he hurt Kapanke, because DeNoor was running on certainly a more conservative libertarian position. But I think, as Joe said, these were two really well-known candidates. So it wasn't like people who were voting for DeNoor didn't know Kapanke and didn't understand that they were hurting his candidacy. My guess is that most of the people who voted for DeNoor would have left their ballot blank, because this was clearly a protest vote against the other two candidates. But would there have been maybe 60 of those voters who, if they would have known the outcome of the race, changed their vote? It's possible. I think that it was close enough that DeNoor's voters probably did in the end hurt Kapanke in the race.
Keith, I want to return to something that you mentioned earlier, and that's you know, really the role of rural voters in this race. You know, and I want to talk about this obviously when we get to the presidential election as well. But you know, what role did they have in the outcome of this the 32nd Senate race?
Well, I think they made it close. Of course, Chip DeNoor was quite outspoken in his support of Donald Trump. So perhaps he might have harmed Kapanke in that Trump voters might have naturally selected Kapanke in that race. But the rural vote, I think we were presuming, and across the country, as well as in this state Senate district, that many of these rural voters had been that portion of the electorate or portion of the public that had not availed themselves to voting. And so these were either returning voters after some period of time being out of the electorate, or potentially even new first-time voters, and you can anecdotally at least encounter those people. After the national conventions, in discussing this race, I strongly suggested that Act 10 was still a vital issue in this area, and I think still that does linger. That is, this district, this area, as Joe said, La Crosse has become very, very solidly Democratic, and I think that the Act 10 legislation still lingers for many voters, especially in the city of La Crosse, and in an area where education is very strongly supported.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about the 2016 elections. What happened this week, and why do the polls get it so wrong? We're here with UWL professors Tim Dale and Joe Heim, and Viterbo professor Keith Knutson. Moving on to another state legislative race, the 96th Assembly seat, in which covers Vernon, Crawford, and Monroe counties, Representative Lee Nearson was reelected pretty handily with 60% of the vote. Joe, were we really expecting anything different in this race?
The only thing that was a surprise is the margin. And that, I think, goes along with the rural vote that seemed to shift Republican in this particular election. I'm not sure whether that's a permanent or temporary thing. If you look back at Lee Nearson's record, at various times he's had relatively close elections. I remember he had a recall, back two or three elections ago. But his margins have been fairly safe. But his district has oftentimes voted Democratic. So if he wins, say, 55-45 and Barack Obama carries the county, you realize a lot of people are splitting their votes. So for a lot of people who are voting for Democrats at the top, they would have to shift to, Lee Nearson. He's basically been there a long time. He's popular. He claims not to be a standard Republican. He voted, for example, against the Walker budget. He tends to defend Western interests pretty well, and I think the district likes him personally. He's a very likable guy. And he also isn't somebody that goes after people in a negative sort of a way. The interesting thing about this election was that there was an outside group spending huge amounts of money against his opponent on radio, and I'd say I heard ads every day for the last month or so. And I frankly wondered why. The implication of that is that maybe Lee Nearson was in trouble, but his margin of, I think it was 62% that he had, was probably his highest that he's ever had.
So what does this say about Representative Nearson for future elections?
I think he's become safer. I think a lot of Democrats have looked at that district thinking it should be Democratic because it mostly and oftentimes votes Democratic for statewide races. So I think a lot of Democrats down there have been, thinking this is the time we can get Lee Nearson eventually, and it just hasn't happened. Either they haven't had the right candidate or people cross over for Lee Nearson. And he does, he follows local issues, and he does go against his own party. For example, there was an issue about access to the Mississippi River, which, frankly, a lot of legislators in Wisconsin, what's that all about? And it had to do with railroads and getting across railroad tracks to get into the river. Very big issue in that area. And Lee went to bat for his district and essentially fought the governor and fought the DNR and others to try to get that put into the budget. So it's, I think he's viewed as a local legislator who really does go bat for his district. And frankly, he's a likable guy.
Tim, did you have thoughts on this race?
Yeah, well, that's my district, and I can say that it's not only to the airwaves, but it's also to mailers. There were pro-Lee Nearson mailers that were coming in by the stacks in the last week of the election, so they were spending a lot of money on that race. And I think in part there was concern maybe if there was a Clinton surge that they wanted to make sure that Lee was protected. But I think there's also the idea that if Republicans are going to hold the legislature, they have to hold seats like Lee Nearson's. And I want to echo what Joe just mentioned, which is in that particular district, there's a lot of crossover votes for Lee Nearson. It's a really good example where in political science we say all politics is local. And these candidates aren't just abstract ideas. They're people who people know in the district. And so people in the district know Lee Nearson. And if he's going to be challenged by a Democrat successfully, it's going to have to be someone like Lee Nearson who's really well-liked. And people in the district are going to be willing, and the opposite side, to cross over maybe from Republican and vote for the Democrat. But that's why it's become a safer seat, is because of how much support Lee's gained in the district.
And Keith, what are your thoughts on the 96th?
Well, I agree. Lee Nearson is a likable guy, and the longer he's there, and he's been there some time now, I would venture to describe him after this election as a pretty securely ensconced in that seat.
And another incumbent representative, Steve Doyle, also held on to his seat in the 94th Assembly District. One of the Democrats who was able to hold on to their seat despite this Republican surge that we've been kind of talking about. Keith, why do you think, Steve Doyle was able to kind of hold on?
Well, I had the pleasure of attending a debate at West Salem High School that Joe got to moderate with a high school student who put the debate together. And both candidates presented themselves very effectively. Doyle's message was he is one of the few Democrats who's had some success in crossing party lines in getting legislation through the state assembly and even signed by the governor. So Doyle seems to be on the north side of the state Senate district what Lee Nearson is on the southern side, and that is someone who's not an ideologue, and I don't mean to imply that the person in between, Jill Billings, is either. As a matter of fact, she didn't even have an opponent this time around. But Doyle, with his county executive experience, is presenting himself as a middle-of-the-road politician who's really interested in getting things done. And, of course, for something like a decade, even more before that, Mike Hipsch held that seat quite securely in the Republican column. And so Doyle's doing a very effective job of presenting himself as a can-do kind of politician.
Joe, what are your thoughts on why Steve Doyle was able to hold on to his seat?
I think he recognizes this district leans Republican. I believe that Donald Trump did carry that district slightly. I was told that. And he knows that. This is probably, at any given election, this is probably one of the top three or four districts that the Republicans think they should be able to win because it leans Republican. It's a suburban district, basically. Steve Doyle knows that, so he doesn't relax on his laurels. He works hard, goes door to door, believe it or not, a lot, frankly. And he doesn't forget his district, and he maintains a visibility in the district as well as being on the county board. I think I'd throw in the fact that in addition to working hard as a, you know, he's got kind of a bipartisan brand, if you want to call it that. He works at that really carefully. I think his opponent, Julian Bradley, tried to use a TV ad to knock into that, but it didn't really, I don't think it was particularly effective, unfortunately, for him. Steve Doyle was running a lot of ads, and he said, this is a non, remember at the very end, this is a non-attack ad put together by Steve Doyle, something like that. And it it indicates that he does not believe in attacking his opponent. And a lot of people appreciate that, frankly. So I think he's probably the right type of a moderate Democrat to be able to hold on to that district, which was designed to be a Republican district.
And I think one of the most surprising election results was in the 92nd Assembly seat, with incumbent Democrat Chris Dano losing to Republican challenger Craig Prochinsky. He was one of two Democrats to lose their seat, the other being Senator Julie Lassa in the 24th Senate District. Tim, you know, what happened there?
Yeah, this may be a race that we end up putting in the column of the Trump wave having an impact. Really, when we look across the state, and actually across multiple states, particularly in the northern Midwest, Trump's victory in the presidential race really showed that he pulled a lot of voters from rural areas that we have not seen turning out to the level that they've turned out. And I think in that particular race, we see the result of that, and really a casualty of the presidential year.
That's Tim Dale, political science professor at UWL, here with us today to talk about the results of this week's election. Also joining us in studio are Joe Heim, political science professor at UWL, and Keith Knutson, history professor at Viterbo University. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. And so Republicans were able to hold on to their majority in the legislature this year. And actually, the legislature has become, you know, more conservative after this year's elections. Joe, what does this mean for the state?
Well, that's interesting. It's continuing a trend of certain sense. And to be honest, I think most Republicans thought they were going to lose one, maybe two seats in the state Senate, probably lose three or four seats in the Assembly. The Assembly was 63-36, if I remember right. So the general perception on both sides is that that the Democrats were expected to pick up seats. And part of that was just the general assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to carry Wisconsin. Wisconsin's been voting Democratic presidential for a long time. That kind of a higher turnout would advantage them. Turned out not to be true because of Donald Trump as much as anybody. There are a few surprises, obviously. Julie Lassa, for example, lost, and I don't think anybody predicted that to happen. The areas that were the toss-up districts for the Democrats, they did not pick up. The two that they thought were most likely they were going to get, they didn't get. And the third one, which they were hoping to get to take over the majority, not only that, but none of those races that they were hoping for were even close. And throw in the fact that in the 32nd, you have a district which was perceived to be more safe, turned out to be a real toss-up. So it also, I think, reflects on the Walker machine. People underestimate the fact that Governor Walker and Republicans in Wisconsin have figured out a pretty good way of getting out their vote. And, you know, it's widely discussed that the Democrats know how to do this sort of stuff. But the fact is, they have not been as effective in Wisconsin as perhaps they have been elsewhere in their get-out-to-vote drives. I think the Republicans have been better at it, frankly, and that certainly advantaged the Republicans. Throw in one more thing, and that's the redistricting issue and the gerrymandering. It's fairly clear that it's going to be hard for, unless they redesign those districts to be more competitive, it's going to be difficult for the Democrats to take over the Assembly, certainly, when it's virtually almost 2-1. The most they were hoping for in this election was just to pick up three or four seats, and then maybe next election pick up three or four seats. But in fact, it seems to be going in the other direction.
Right. The redistricting process that, you know, many people say has given a sizable advantage to incumbents, most of those being Republican, obviously. You know, Tim, did we see that play out, that, you know, most people were able to hold on to their seats and the Republicans really, you know, were safe?
Right. Well, and generally speaking, we see a large incumbency advantage in any election. And certainly when you're in office, there are a lot of advantages that get built in. Being able to draw districts is one advantage. Being able to pass legislation for that helps people in your district is another advantage. Having a mobilization effort for voters when you have the governorship and the legislature, as Joe was just talking about. I think all of those things kind of build in an advantage that we saw as a result in this election. And if the Democrats were going to pick up seats, it was going to be because there were bigger issues, bigger dynamics at play. And actually, all those dynamics ended up going Republicans' way, too. So I think all of those factors led to the result that we saw on Tuesday.
So are there any, really competitive elections in the state based on this week's results?
I think that that's where we can look forward to future elections and see some elections that happened even in this area. So the Kopanke-Schilling race shows that there are districts like that across the state, that even when you have redistricting, even when you have incumbency advantage, you can still make elections competitive. A lot of times it is driven by the people who are running in particular races, but there also could be waves. So we saw waves when Barack Obama turned out a lot of voters in 2008 and 2012. So the same kind of dynamic we saw on the Republican side this year, I don't think there's any reason to believe that we couldn't see elections like that in the future that would shift the way these districts are voting.
And so returning, to the idea that, the legislature has become more Republican, and obviously, our governor is Republican. Keith, what does this mean for, future legislation for the next, legislative session in the state?
I think the Republicans are in a good position to get their agenda through over the next 2 years, and in the next election 2 years out, a non-presidential election. Traditionally, Democratic Party supporters are less likely to turn out, and we get as low a national voter turnout as somewhere in the mid-30s. And so that wouldn't bode well for the Democrats trying to regain traction at the state government level. That will also be a gubernatorial race. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Governor Walker. There's been some discussion about potentially a cabinet selection by Donald Trump with Governor Walker. That if that were the case, then we'd have an open gubernatorial seat, and that might then energize Democrats in a midterm election, which would be helpful. But on the legislative level, I do think that the gerrymandered districts are dictating that the Republicans have a cushion, so that it would have to be a mighty wave for the Democrats to regain control of the state legislature in any two-year cycle. This would be a long-term aspiration for the Democrats. And potentially then, of course, unforeseen, untoward events will impact elections, no one hopes for that sort of thing. But of course, one element of the Obama wave in 08 was the Great Recession. We've had a steady economic improvement in the last, 5-6 years even. But still, this election nationwide was an election of economic uncertainty. So I think we're in a period of unknowingness of what will be our election outcomes. And of course, then this year, another important factor, personality. And I'm taking it to the presidential level now, but a lack of policy proposals out of Donald Trump, only the vaguest of notions as to what might be the result of his assumption of office, opposed to a policy wonk who constantly referred to her webpage to reference her the myriad of her policies, Hillary Clinton, I think that our election outcomes are set for the rest of the decade due to gerrymandering. And then the next presidential election in 2020, that will be the census, and potentially we'll see some realignment on the gerrymandered districts. I would add one more thing. President Obama has publicly committed to engaging the nation on this election, this representative district drawing, gerrymandering. In the last general election, the Democrats won more votes nationwide than the Republicans and didn't get a result in the House of Representatives. This is an alienating condition by which voter turnout can actually be suppressed.
And, you know, the last time that, or when, rather, the Republicans, you know, took control of the legislature and had control of the, you know, the governor's position, you know, we saw a lot of big changes in the state. And we've seen that since they took control. Joe, do you think that we're going to see more big changes coming?
I would say relatively smaller changes. Usually when a party takes over the legislature or takes over total control of a government, they move their major issues, their major agenda up forward, and they did. So over the last 3 or 4 years, the Republicans have moved a lot of their traditionally important things like right-to-work laws, for example. So they got a lot of the big stuff done already. There's always more to do, of course, but the major stuff has been done. So this essentially the next 2 years will set up the elections for the governorship. And Governor Walker right now is not terribly popular, but he thinks he can overcome that if he has to. But essentially, as Tim said earlier, power of incumbency makes a big difference. And a lot of this, when you have one party control of the state legislature, the state governorship, the money flows to that party. You know, if you want to have any influence and you want to spend money to get some of that open door influence, the money goes to the majority party, and that's the Republicans. So they're going to take full advantage of that. Throw in the fact that even interest groups that would necessarily give some money to the Democratic Party might be less inclined to do so because of their minority status. Throw in the fact that the Act 10 has undercut some of the major sources of money for the Democrats. I'm talking about union money. That makes their money collection a little more difficult. Throw in one other thing. If you haven't noticed it, the Democrats have had a more difficult time coming up with candidates for statewide races. I like to say that their bench is relatively shallow. And typically, for example, you might look at congressional seats that might be willing to move up to be a governor. And you look at those names and you realize that Ron Kind, for example, has been and will be talked about as a potential gubernatorial candidate. But you look at other statewide office holders, Secretary of State La Follette, he's not likely going to be running for the governorship anytime soon. And there really is a shortage of well-known, well-respected Democrats that are close to looking like they're ready to step up for the governorship.
Joe Heim, political science professor at UWL, is here with us today to talk about the 2016 elections, from the presidential race to local legislative seats. He's joined in studio by UWL professor Tim Dale and Viterbo professor Keith Knutson. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on the results of this year's elections. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Pollsters and pundits were surprised with the result of the 2016 elections, from the presidential race to local legislative seats. Now that voters have cast their ballots, we'll talk about the results of this week's elections and what it means for the future of America, Wisconsin, and the Cooley region. Joining us today are Tim Dale, political science professor at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse, Joe Heim, also a political science professor at UWL, and Keith Knutson, a history professor from Viterbo University. And so now I want to go to the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin this year. Republican Senator Ron Johnson, I believe, was slightly behind in the polls going into the election, but it was obviously a close race. But he held on to a seat with 50% of the vote. Tim, you know, what kind of happened in that race?
Well, one of the interesting things about the election, and I think when you get down to the lower level of surprises that we had, was that all the talk was that, and the worry, particularly among Republicans, was that Donald Trump was going to suppress their turnout. So you saw a lot of members of Congress, both in the Senate and the House, distancing themselves from the presidential candidate. And I think one of the big surprises from Tuesday, and this was for Republicans as much as it was for Democrats, is that Donald Trump looks like he helped a lot of congressional representatives, including the Senate race in Wisconsin. And so rather than feeling like Johnson was working against a flow of Trump, anti-Trump voters, he actually kind of carried a wave. Now, Johnson overperformed Trump in the state, which we kind of expected. There were going to be some ballot splitting, which would have favored Johnson. But even so, Johnson's margin was surprising, and in part it was because of the wave that we saw for Republicans.
Joe, what were you most surprised about in the U.S. Senate race?
I think the last surge of the whole thing. The polls had, as Tim said, the polls had Johnson ahead through the entire summer and fall, and there was kind of a perception in some respects that Feingold was one of the two or three national races, which it was going to be a takeover for the Democrats. Obviously, the Trump effect really affected the race as well. But I also think that Johnson ran a very smart race. He was attacking very early and often, identifying Feingold as almost an incumbent. Initially, he tried to tie him to Washington, and I think most people know in Wisconsin the guy's a maverick. So that didn't work. But they tried different approaches, you know, see what stuck, basically. In the last week or two, they had some very strong ads. And by the way, a lot of outside money flew into this race because it was, had such a national scope to it. And I think Johnson found some very effective things. He had a little more of a, took advantage of the Republican surge, obviously, but I think he ran very effective ads. Some of the ads made it look like Feingold was the incumbent. If this is an anti-incumbent year or anti-DC, make Feingold look like the incumbent. They were talking about votes that he had done 10, 12 years ago, and they were acting like they were yesterday. And I think they're very effective, particularly veterans issues, defense issues, terrorism. All issues which I think Republicans are particularly good at. And Feingold had a difficult time at the very last week, you know, countering those, basically. So it's a combination of ingredients that held on to the seat for Senator Johnson.
Keith, was there anything that Russ Feingold could have or should have done differently in this race, or was it kind of a surprise?
I felt Feingold ran an effective race, I do think overwhelmed, but I compare him with Evan Bayh in Indiana, both former senators coming back to, I would say, use their name recognition, and the early polling was that both of these gentlemen would rather handily win their races. Joe said Republicans are pretty effective with terrorism. I think you might have meant campaigning on terrorism. One wonders about the effectiveness of their policies or even their proposals. So that I don't think terrorism played a case in necessarily in the Feingold loss, but in general, the Republicans have been very effective at painting their Democratic opponents as inside Washington, connected lobbyists, and Evan Bayh in Indiana had done that. Russ Feingold, kind of like Hillary Clinton, had an organization to which Johnson could tie him and paint a picture of a corrupted candidate. In my estimation, that was a very challenging issue for Feingold, but there was nothing he could have done about that, of course, because he had chosen to engage in his public aspirations. And I think here for our society, one of the challenges we face is how can these former elected officials continue to engage in public aspirations where there will, of course, be money raised to engage the organization they're working through? And is this a legitimate activity, or do these people then need to step away from aspiration to public office? Do we see this as part of our public corruption? And I think this is a dangerous trend because, in my view, both these Hillary and the Clinton Foundation and Feingold are doing good work, even on the international stage, good work that the government of the United States is not necessarily getting done. I think this is a dilemma for us in our leadership role in the world.
I think what's weighing most heavily on everyone's mind is the presidential election and just how unexpected it was. Tim, why did the polls get it so wrong, especially in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, this is a question that people who run polls are asking themselves, and I don't do that, luckily, so I don't have to answer for any polls that I conducted. But one of the things that we can say is that polls are always an estimation. There's a lot of complicated math that goes into projecting how turnout is going to play out. And so when people see a poll result, it isn't just that people were literally asked a question and then that result was reported to people as a pure number. People who run polls have to model what the turnout is going to look like and then take the people who responded to polls and adjust those numbers based on who's going to turn out. And so what we saw on Tuesday was a turnout that looked different than what a lot of pollsters were modeling. And so, for example, in the state of Wisconsin, Donald Trump actually matched almost identically the number of votes that Mitt Romney got 4 years ago. But the big difference was that Hillary Clinton underperformed Barack Obama's turnout by about 300,000 votes. And so that is where, if you were going to say that 2016 was going to look like 2012, you would predict that Clinton would win because the turnout, if it's about the same, would be Democrat-Republican about the same. And this is an example of where if you don't guess right in terms of the turnout, you're going to get the final result wrong. And I think I would add that one of the big questions that we're going to be talking about for a while is whether or not Wisconsin has turned into a red state. And one of the conversations that happened after Scott Walker's victory and Republicans took over the state legislature, a lot of which happened outside of presidential years, is that we said, well, Wisconsin tends Republican in non-presidential elections. But in presidential elections, Democrats really could count on Democratic turnout. And so we actually see, as of Tuesday, that Wisconsin looks a lot more red than it did just a few days ago. And this will have an impact on how polls are conducted in the future, because now we're going to ask the question, is it going to look like 2016 or is it going to look like 2012?
I think, talking about this, the state leaning more Democratic in presidential years, more Republican in the off years, the gubernatorial years, I think the Cooley region, the Western Wisconsin, really does that as well. And obviously this year, Western Wisconsin was very Republican. I mean, La Crosse and Eau Claire counties looked like little blue islands in a sea of red. I mean, Joe, can you talk a little bit about why Western Wisconsin didn't follow its usual trend?
Oh, I think a lot of it has to do with Donald Trump. If you look at the campaigns, and by the way, some of this has to do with things have been going on for a long time. Immigration became more of a rural issue, not just in Wisconsin, but much of the Midwest. Trump did substantially better amongst the rural voters, and some of it was some of his issues, particularly the immigration issue, which I think a lot of rural people became a little more fearful. So I think that was a big part of it. And I'm not sure it's the economy so much. I was thinking about that, whether the rural economy just hasn't been doing as well, but I'm not sure that's it. Although farms were a little down this year. But in general, I don't think the economy was the issue. I think it was really more national types of things. But I've noticed in the last couple of elections, particularly northern rural Wisconsin has been becoming more Republican, even in years which the Democrats win. So that's not the sole explanation for this. But it remains to be seen whether we're going to go back to our normal patterns or whether we have more of a Republican shift that is for the state a little more permanently red. I tend to think we're going to go back to our normal patterns.
And as Tim mentioned, Hillary Clinton just really didn't get the number of votes that she was expected to get in the state. Keith, why do you think there were not as many Democratic votes?
Well, I think here Joe cites Donald Trump as getting out the vote on the Republican side, and nationwide, something like 7 million fewer votes for Democrats across the country. So Hillary Clinton turned out to be in a turnout the Rascals election, or in Donald Trump's term, drain the swamp in Washington, Hillary Clinton then could be identified as a political insider. One of the aspirations late in the campaign of the Trump Organization was to run negative advertising and suppress the vote. I'm not so sure we can draw a direct correlation one to the other, but certainly the Democratic turnout was suppressed. We might give some credit to the Trump campaign and their negative advertising, but I think the onus would lie on the candidate herself, and the aspiration to have the first female president, very inspiring to many women here in the upper Midwest. I think that Hillary only struck an even balance with Trump among females. And so that candidacy, I think we have to conclude, fell a little flat.
Let me throw in one other thing that I think is the kind of the elephant in the room. This is a change election. After it is well known that after two terms in the White House, people tend to want a change. You could just hear people, well, it's time for a change. You know, we gave the other side 8 years. And frankly, Washington hasn't operated real well in the last few years. You could blame the Democrats or Republicans, but the public tends to blame the White House a little bit more. So this was a change election. One of the statistics that I thought was amazing, exit polls showed that roughly 60% of the public thought that Donald Trump was not qualified to be president. Roughly 60% thought that he did not have the temperament to be president. Yet it's clear that many of those people voted for him. So you're thinking, whoa, this is interesting. You know, it goes against conventional thinking. But it tells you essentially that people were saying, well, I don't think he's temperament, but it's time for a change. Hillary Clinton, unfortunately, was not the change candidate. She, for a variety of reasons, she tied herself to the Obama administration, when in fact she should have, if in retrospect this all looks better, she could have distanced herself away from that. In the spring, I think she would have liked to have become more of a moderate candidate. Unfortunately, Bernie Sanders pulled her further to the left, so she had further place to go to get back to the middle. So she was a candidate which clearly followed Obama. She was not the change candidate. She was more liberal than what I think the public was looking for this time around, all of which kind of, and thrown the idea of change. When in doubt, you know, they had the Clintons around for 30 years, and it's time for change. Let's try the new guy. And people were more enamored by that than simply going with, you know, steady as you go.
If I could add one more statistic to that story, is also Obama's approval rating, which was 56% the day before the election, according to Gallup tracking polls. So he's getting close to 60%, which not only means that there are people who thought Donald Trump didn't have the temperament to be president who voted for Donald Trump, but there are people who approved of Barack Obama's job as president who also voted for Donald Trump. And so this is where I think those kind of numbers contrasted to each other show just how interesting the outcome was.
And probably a good reason why Hillary did try to tie herself to Obama with his approval ratings. The public in general, that is the Democratic Party supporters, seem not to have been so appreciative of the gains made, at least early in the Obama administration, Wall Street regulation, the Affordable Health Care Act, Obama's work on immigration through executive orders. So I think Hillary's strategy of tying herself to Obama was a logical one, but the mood of the country, that is the people who turned out. And once again, I think the lack of animation among Democratic Party supporters, and this is one of the big challenges for the Democratic Party, how to get its supporters actually to the polls, despite their get out the vote effort. There's a real weakness here within those who identify as Democrats that they want the results, but I have the impression they're not prepared, even to too many of them, in my estimation, to get to the voting place and support their candidates.
That's Viterbo Professor Keith Knutson here with us today to talk about the results of this week's election. Also joining us in studio are UWL professors Joe Heim and Tim Dale. Tim, I want to talk about voter participation in the state because it was down this year in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about the numbers and, you know, why possibly that is?
Well, the reason that voters vote is a really interesting question and a complicated one. A lot of people are going to be spending sleepless nights wondering what happened and how they might be able to change what happened in Wisconsin. I think that there's a lot of talk before an election, and we talked about it a lot, the get out the vote effort of candidates and parties. And one of the reasons why a lot of people were predicting a Clinton victory, maybe even outside the margin of error pro-Clinton, was that she had invested a lot in traditional get-out-the-vote efforts, things that have proven to work. But I think one of the things that Tuesday showed is that get-out-the-vote is a lot more complicated of a question than just, do you have field operations? Have you paid people to go door-to-door? There's also a get-out-the-vote effort that's just based on how strongly people feel toward a particular candidate. And one of the interesting things about Tuesday is it looks like Donald Trump's theory of the electorate was pretty spot on, which is that there were people that were disillusioned and disaffected that really resonated with what Donald Trump said. And so not having a traditional get out the vote effort at the same level as Hillary Clinton didn't seem to matter all that much. And that's one of the things that I think is going to change some theories of election. A big question that we're going to have, though, is whether or not what we saw on Tuesday was a Donald Trump once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon, or is this something that we're going to have to pay attention to going forward? Is the politics of personality going to trump, no pun intended, traditional views of voter turnout?
Keith, your thoughts.
Yes, and now Donald Trump and the Republicans are actually going to have to govern. So Trump played a pretty effective campaign as a charismatic authoritarian leader, those who supported him seem to have displayed some significant degree of devotion to the values and the social order that he envisions. Of course, a significant number of Republican elected officials kept a distance from Trump. They're rallying behind him now, but how far is President Trump going to go with some of his policy aspirations and then his own personal behavior? We saw in the campaign that there's a decided odious element of Donald Trump's personality and personal history. How long is this a marriage of rather divergent views of how public officials should behave and present themselves? How long is that going to last for the Republicans in Washington, D.C., the lawmakers working with the president?
Yeah, and we're already seeing protests since the results were announced early Wednesday, across the country. Joe, do you think that we're going to be able to overcome this division as a country, as a state, and what do we need to do to accomplish that?
Well, I hate to say it, but my quick answer is no. I just don't see us pulling together. People say this every 4 years: we're going to pull together and unite the party, unite the country, all that, and it never works. 6 months later, the honeymoon's over with, and it's war as usual. The fact that this election was so divisive, I don't see it. That divisiveness going to bed, and I think we saw it last night on across the country. By the way, the turnout across the country was low. I've got the numbers here: 53% turnout at U.S. level. That's sometimes we've been closer to 59-60% nationally. Wisconsin was at 66%, which was a 20-year low. La Crosse County, by the way, was 68.9%, which is pretty good, but still they were predicting more than that. We oftentimes are more than that. So the turnout across the board was low. I think part of that has to do with the negativity of the races. People get turned off by it, negativity in general. I think the unpopularity of the two candidates, I think, was a factor in the whole thing. I also think that this became, as I think I agree with my colleagues here, that this was more of a personality contest. There really were no major burning issues that caused huge waves of people. No MIG wars. The economy was going okay. So, the kind of major issues that sometimes drive elections, big crises, sometimes drive elections in the past, just really wasn't there. So they were missing some things. Plus, throw in the uniqueness of Donald Trump. I don't think we're going to see another election like this. In fact, I'm going to say I hope not. But I really think Donald Trump is a unique character, and I just don't think people are going to be able to replicate that in the future. The combination of a national well-known name, the celebrity status of his, he had some advantages. Plus, his personality just was very attractive at the right time for those people who are very disaffected by the elections.
We have about 30 seconds left. Tim, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think when we talk about division, we should also talk about division within the parties. The Republicans now leading the country do not agree with each other on many important issues. Same with Democrats. They're going to do some soul searching. So we're not just talking about a national division, Republicans and Democrats. We're also talking about divisions within the parties that the parties themselves are going to have to spend some time thinking about and working through.
We've been talking with Tim Dale, political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Joe Heim, another political science professor at UWL, and Keith Knutson, a history professor from Viterbo University, about the results of the 2016 elections. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.